Monster in a Glass, the podcast where we explore cocktails and look at the history surrounding them, the people who made them, the people who drank them, and then other crazy stuff involved with the name or the history around that time. This episode is going to focus on the Golden Dawn, that famous cocktail that we all ask for when we go belly up to the bar. Give me a Golden Dawn, Rudy.
Rudy.
I'm just throwing out a bartender name. I'm here with Jason Cruz, our researcher.
Hello.
He's explored the Golden Dawn, tried to figure out the story of the Golden Dawn. And my other co-host is losing it, Mr. Nick Layman.
There you go. Golden Dawn.
Wait, everywhere. This is the Golden Dawn? I thought it was the Red Dawn. I've researched Red Dawn. This is all about Patrick Swayze, right?
I hope so.
We can make it be all about Brent Patrickson.
So, the Golden Dawn. Now, our book says that it's all about a musical.
It's not. Let's just start there. It's not. These are always give me a little bit of pleasure doing these. Although it's frustrating at the same time because, yeah, it starts off talking about the musical. But let's talk about the recipe first. We'll talk about why it's not about the musical in a minute. But the recipe is kind of interesting. The Golden Dawn is 3/4 ounce of Calvados, 3/4 ounce of dry gin, 3/4 ounce of apricot-flavored brandy or apricot brandy, 1/4 ounce of orange juice, and then grenadine. And the first thing I noticed,
tequila,
I was like,
tequila sunrise.
I didn't even think about
it. Calvados sunrise.
Yeah, right. Calvados sunrise. But what I did notice was that it is roughly a 3-ounce drink, and 2.5 ounces is booze. And then there's
my kind of drink.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wake up.
But also like Calvados gin and brain. I mean that it's. I think gin to me is like, whoa. That's,
yeah. The changes.
It doesn't
everything.
Really seem like it goes with it, but. It's probably a pretty boozy drink. This drink does not actually show up in really many cocktail books at all. I could really only find it in a couple, which is not surprising because it was, by all accounts, invented in 1930. So I found it in
pretty, huh?
Yeah.
The Along the Wine Trail, 1935. And they have the Golden Dawn and then the Golden Dawn 2. Now, the Golden Dawn 2...
It deserved a sequel?
It did. This time it's personal.
Patrick Swayze returns in Golden Dawn 2.
Was there a Tootsie Roll reckoning. This time?
Yeah. Bloop. Just put... Yeah, right?
What the hell is this? It's a Golden Dawn number 2, you fucker.
And what's weird is that he gives the recipe for the Golden Dawn is 2 parts orange juice, 2 parts gin, and 1 part apricot liqueur, which is not... But the Golden Dawn 2 is the recipe that Ted Haig gives. Hmm. So, you know, and so I find it there. Trader Vic has a... But he just grabbed everything he could find and put it in his 1947 book. The place that Haig says it was invented at... International cocktail competition by the UK Bartenders Guild. So I started there. Now, the UK Bartenders Guild.
Did they have those all the time because they needed to fill their cocktail book?
I think maybe they started around that time, though. Around the, like, either 1930 or around that. I don't know if it was the first one or what, but it definitely shows up in the Cafe Royal cocktail book and attributes it to a man named Thomas Buttery, which is when I was like, bullshit, that's not your name. Buttery.
Isn't that one of the characters from South Park?
Butters.
But he was the head of the cocktail bar at the Berkeley Hotel.
That's how he got the job, just the name alone.
Yeah, they were like, your last name's what? You're hired.
You can't make a bad drink with that name.
And it's also, yeah, it's in the Cafe Royal cocktail book. It says invented by the late T. Buttery. So by 1937, he had already died. And the competition was in 1930. So it gives the recipe, orange juice, brandy, Calvados, gin, grenadine, to be added after the cocktail is poured out. So all the ingredients, the grenadine is added afterwards. So I started looking into this, and you know, the recipe books were no help because they're just, it doesn't show up in any places. And which is not surprising. A lot of, like you were saying, the Cafe Royal cocktail book, they were just trying to get every single thing. They were just
and
like,
it was a contest winner. I mean, it's not
he
like,
was a contest winner.
It didn't develop any... Did it develop a following? Did it...
Not that I could find. I mean, you would think that even by... Even 1930, you
That's
still had a few...
fucking forgotten.
Right. Yeah. It didn't... You know, but there was newspaper articles, but they were really covering the cocktail competition, which made me think, like, maybe this was the first one that they put out. But there are quite a few articles about it, and they talk about the Golden Dawn being concocted by Thomas Buttery, and that he worked at the Berkeley Hotel. They would give the recipe. What was interesting is that, like, reading through some of these, the number of drinks that the jury or the judges tested just kind of ranges. It's like, they drank 1,500 drinks. We were like,
yeah.
But then, like, I was like, that's impossible. And then other ones are like, I don't think... There was one article that was like, I don't think that... I think that's bullshit. Like, like even at the time, I was like, I don't think it was 1,500.
Yeah.
But another one was like, no, there were juries of, like, 5 or 6 people. And they would each try 5 drinks. Now, they didn't say how many juries there were. So, I mean, if there was, like, 20 juries, they could reasonably have...
Tasting that much.
But, you know, they talk about the other drinks, like the Sunny Boy that they thought would win. But one of the articles in here... was talking about how people were kind of mad. They said, the purists in cocktails, I learned, are hurt at this choice, as they believe that fruit juice of any kind in a cocktail is against the whole spirit of the stimulant. They said, also, it is argued that the mixture of gin and brandy is unorthodox and unfriendly to man. And I'm like, yeah, it sounds like...
Pretty much.
I would not mix gin and brandy. That would not be my first choice for, like... What would that be, like
a
buttery iced tea? So, you know, there was that. But, I mean, really, they talked about it. But it didn't really show up anywhere. But as you said, it's not that surprising. It was a cocktail competition winner. I mean, how often would you be like, unless it was amazing, unless it tasted amazing.
From my experience looking at these cocktails that have become popular, the ones that were contest winners were picked up and marketed. Promoted, usually through books or movies.
Right, and really, like if you had, even if you have it as a winner in this cocktail competition, if you had bartenders or whoever the purists are that they're describing saying, it's not a cocktail, and they're kind of annoyed. It's like, you put fruit juice in it. It's not a cocktail. That's just a mixed drink. You know, we've sort of touched on this before with other drinks. You know, talking about like, well, what does make, you know, what is a cocktail actually? Like, what do they consider a cocktail? You know, a lot of people say traditionally it's, you know, sugar, water, spirit, and bitters, and that's a cocktail. You know, something like an Old Fashioned or a Manhattan is often pointed to as like, that's a true cocktail, where everything else is just kind of a mixed drink.
Yeah.
And they also point to Jerry Thomas, who is sort of being, you know, one of the first people that sort of separated those out. And if you go to his books, I mean, there is a section. I mean, the whole book is filled with punches and cobblers and crustas and fizzes and... But cocktails are its own section. It's not...
Yeah, and so is a crusta, and so is a fizz,
right.
And each one is its own. I think that the use of the word cocktail, I don't know if it's recent to kind of blanket term for mixed drink.
Well,
like, if they held to those distinctions, because I feel like Prohibition was like a breaking point, where...
Yeah.
All of a sudden,
anything went.
Everything on the other side of Prohibition was, everything was kind of restated.
Yeah, you had more fruit juice, you had all kinds of mixers, so, you know, it's like, are you going to really split hairs when you're getting your booze off the back of a truck or
right.
in a basement, you know, like,
yeah.
It's a cocktail, whatever, just, you mix stuff together and it has booze in it, it's a cocktail.
Will it get me drunk? Yes.
Right, right. I want to talk about it.
Right.
I just want to drink it.
I don't want to feel fancy.
Were they using the term cocktail as mixed drink prior to Prohibition?
They were. But even like, okay, so you have Jerry Thomas, and he made cocktails, and that was sort of the, if you look at the recipes that he had listed under cocktails, they're all pretty much the same. Sugar, water, bitters, a spirit. Harry Johnson also seemed to follow the same thing. But then, you know, so that's 1880s.
But then later people are like, I don't have time for this.
Right.
Right. I mean,
let's just call it a cocktail and be done with it.
You know, I don't know if at the time, though, if, like, Jerry Thomas would have been like, sir, that is not a cocktail. You put, you know, something else. You know, it's like, was
just
he
buy
that?
It.
Like, if a customer came in and was like, give me a cocktail, I'll have this. And he would he be like, That is not a cocktail.
Right.
That's a crusta.
Right.
Or would he just serve his drink because, you know, the guy's paying? I was looking through a bunch of books and they were like talking about cocktails. They're like, they're great for fishing trips and sporting outings. I was like, not really? Like, who's mixing drinks on a... Get in the boat.
That's,
mix the drinks.
That's quite a fishing boat. fishing trip, yeah.
James Bond with like death charges or something. Yeah.
In the 1860s, their boats were much different. They had like tables and...
But drink cart.
Drink cart. And
next to the Evinrude outboard motor.
They also said they were great in the morning or right before dinner. And I was like, yeah, sure.
Better. Right.
But I didn't see anything that was like, you cannot make a cocktail unless you only use these ingredients. It really didn't seem like it was a hard and fast rule. And by the time you even get to the 1890s, cocktails are made with other ingredients. Like, they're calling them cocktails, and then, you know, you get the only William. He's using everything. He's calling everything a cocktail, and everything has 9 ingredients. So.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, okay, yeah. I put all of this shit in here. What the fuck is it? You tell me. What the fuck did I just make?
Yeah. I mean, you have the, like, punches are older, cobblers are older, fizzes seem to be older than cocktails proper, but by the time you get to the 1890s, you know, and really, if you look through these cocktail books in the prefaces and stuff, like, they were not really that concerned with the drinks. It was a craft. They could make them, and they could make them well. But all of them say the same thing. It's like, the customer is the most important thing. You want to serve the customer. You got to make sure everything's clean. They're really more concerned with keeping and tending a proper bar. It's about the presentation. It's about how you mix the drink. It's not so much on, like, what you call it. So that's what I was saying. Like, if it's 1885... You know, somebody's like, I want a cocktail that's got brandy and absinthe and vermouth and bacon and grenadine and pineapple chunks bacon. And pickles and, nice. You know, like, are you really going to... Right, you're going to be like, sir, get out of my bar. Like, that's... It's strange to see a comment in, like, in 1930 where the like, purists... Because I always think of that as, like, nowadays people are like... I feel like the debate is... come back. It's like, that's not a cocktail.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
okay,
get over yourself.
Yeah.
It's a cocktail.
Yeah.
Just serve me your drink. You know, I could see why you wouldn't want to differentiate between, like, a Jack and Coke. I don't know. That was, like, really the only other interesting thing about it. But
so we know where it came from. We know the guy's name. So
yeah, I mean,
we're all set.
So the name. So
yeah,
Hager's like, it's named after this musical called The Golden Dawn.
And I hear that it's a horrible, horrible, racist musical about imperial Africa. Like,
lots of blackface. And,
like,
and
post-World War I.
Mm.
Well, it came out in, like, 1927. The operetta was 1927.
Okay. Mm. Well, the story is supposed to be, like, in Africa... shortly after World War I. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I did a little poking around I thought I was going to be talking about a musical about African imperialism, but...
That's like 500 years of history that it's a lot to cover.
But how do you put that in song?
Yeah, actually, I'm kind
and
of
why?
Intrigued. I kind of want to see the...
Why?
I hear it's really horrible. Like, it wasn't horrible then because it was just the way things were. But, like,
people
now you look at it
time,
and you're like, oh my God, really?
But yeah, it was so definitively, we've seen this with Hag before, so definitively, it was named after this. And it was like,
right.
Uh-huh, okay, well, let's see.
And Buttery never said anything. He wasn't a musical fan.
There was nothing that ever alluded to the name. The only thing that alluded to the name was one of the newspaper articles, which said, if there was only one jury to taste and report on these many drinks, we quite understand why Golden Dawn was adjudged the happiest mixture. It was the 1500th cocktail. This is one of the jurors sampled. And by then, dawn was breaking in the east. Jolly old Golden Dawn was pronounced hesitatingly, but unanimously. The theory is spoiled, however, by the telegram's reference to juries. So they're already saying it's like that was one of the stories of how it got its name. But they're like, no, that sounds like bullshit.
Yeah,
already,
bullshit.
Like at the time, they're saying no, that's not true. So There was no connection. There really was no reason it would be named after it. It didn't make sense. And I have this sneaking suspicion that this was the first Google result, and it was like, good enough, you know, like the Babbo. Like, yeah. Oh, this says this, so that must be true. You know, like, the internet doesn't lie.
It told me so.
So there's no mention of the musical or the film anywhere that I could even find mention of this article. It's not even like a well-known drink, necessarily. But the one thing is that the picture that Hag has in his book of the drink, I was like, oh, it looks like a sunrise.
Yeah, it looks like a Golden Dawn.
Couldn't it be that easy?
I mean, it's easy, right? And I thought, like, you know, it's not the musical, so why else would you call it that? It seems pretty logical, and even the idea that you mix the drink and then you pour the grenadine in, why would you pour the grenadine in last? Because it probably has an effect. If you've seen other mixologists where they do weird things, like, we got to put this in.
Well, tequila sunrise.
Right. It's to create an effect of how it looks. So I was like, all right, that's got to be it. And even Difford's guide says, shake the first 5 ingredients with ice and fine strain into chilled glass. Carefully pour grenadine into center of drink so that it sinks to create a sunrise effect. So I was like, so not named after the musical.
Wow.
Not to mention the fact.
Weird too, because like that one, like you're saying, that musical is so very bad.
Right.
Yeah, and like,
so why would you attach even?
Why like, would yeah. you? Yeah, I mean,
I was like, oh, this guy was really into racist movies, so he invented this drink and named it. And it was like, the guy died like 7 years later. He can't even defend himself. He can't be like,
right?
Oh no, that's some racist shit. Like, no,
don't tie that to my drink.
He was like British. He like,
it wasn't racist at the time. I mean,
it might have been in Britain. They were
maybe.
Maybe not. You know,
I think that it was just accepted, and people, you know, it was the same kind of crap that Europeans and Americans believed about other cultures.
Yeah,
right.
It's like, especially people who you've got your foot on their neck.
Right.
But in any case, I mean, it's still like okay, so you have this beautiful drink that looks like a sunrise, and
that's what kills me. He could have. I mean, like,
so even if he said that, that would have been brilliant though.
Like, how do you overlook
but
that?
But like, how many other things are you utilizing the name Golden Dawn?
Oh, I mean, it shows
up. I mean, I know of the Greek neo-Nazi party that started, like, I mean, it's recent. So it has nothing to do with that.
I think it started, yeah.
Yeah.
But, so was it Aleister Crowley's favorite drink? Is that the only other connection?
See, and that was one of them. But, like, looking through things, I was like, well, I'm just going to see where Golden Dawn shows up in newspapers, British newspapers, 1930. Let's see what's going on. Well, there was a horse. You know, a racing horse by the name of Golden Dawn showed up in time. I mean, it was in this race all through the 19th.
That seems more likely.
Right? Like, maybe he was a horse racing
fan. Yeah.
Like, right. There's a type of climbing rose called the Golden Dawn, which is very popular in Britain. Why not named after the climbing rose? It was all these things. Now, none of these things could connect. We're talking about Aleister Crowley.
Aleister Crowley, yeah.
The Hermetic Order of Golden Dawn, which every time I say it, or
the cocktail is not named after the Hermetic.
It's not named after it. But that was one of the more interesting.
Fucking crazy.
Yeah, it could have been, but maybe Thomas Buttery was a member, and it was like his nod to the Hermetic Order, and it was like
it wasn't grenadine. Let's just
now that you mentioned. But I also want to, like, every time I say hermetic, I'm like, hermetically sealed.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's not the Nazi party from Greece in the 1980s, but, and it's really none of these. It's almost certainly looks like a sunrise, but looking into the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, because I was like, oh, this
here
sounds
we go. Down the rabbit
strange.
Hole.
Strange. Yeah. It's like,
buckle
how
up.
Far down?
and this is, it's from the time period.
So, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was an occult society. It was founded in 1888. And it incorporated, so it's like, you know, already you're like, alright, this is sounding pretty good. 1888 occult society.
Uh-huh.
Incorporated elements of Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, and the Kabbalah. So it was just like,
it's everything! Yeah, it's a grab bag!
It focused both on practical magic and ritual magic. It's like, you can't have rituals.
You got to get places.
You can't have the ritual without the practical. I mean, like, that would just be stupid.
Yeah.
But it was also very short-lived, they said. And I couldn't exactly see. It was, like, 10 years, 20 years. Like, I think it was, like, less than 10 years.
No. Ago. Okay. So...
Well, that the order...
That the actual... Yeah, because they all splintered because everybody...
Yeah.
Disagreed.
Okay, so, yeah, the whole thing was, like... I mean, it was all fabricated bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like... About secret shit, secret society stuff, and then it ended up as an argument over whose bullshit
was more bullshit than the other bullshit.
Yeah. You know,
who could make up the most bullshit?
But don't you think it became somewhat popular because of the presence of women? Like all secret societies prior, it was always like, this is just for boys,
dudes.
Yeah. No, that was one of the things that they mentioned in numerous places, was that it was unique in that it allowed women, and where it didn't others.
That and the crazy parties. I mean, the sex magic alone.
They called it a fraternity, which was originally called the Fraternity of the Esoteric Order of the Golden Dawn.
That's because they dressed the women up as dudes.
Maybe. They're like, you can come in, but you got to dress up like a man.
But sorry. Did you see the names that were affiliated with it, though?
Yeah. So it was started by a Dr. William R. Woodman.
Oh, they never went away, Cam.
They're still here.
They're under your bed right now.
Because we put them there. Yeah. It was founded by Dr. William R. Woodman, Dr. Wynne Westcott, and McGregor Mathers. And I didn't know any of these names, but... So, yeah, they focused, they did, like, magical incantations and symbols, incorporated elements of the Kabbalah and Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry and the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And
Wynne Westcott had a publishing company downtown in Chicago.
Really?
Yeah, the cult is huge in Chicago. It's weird. No,
you know what? And there's actually, if you look up Golden Dawn, you can find a group who has an affiliation to the original here in Chicago.
Yeah, and there's lots of crazy like connections with the architecture and stuff that exists here. It's pretty cool.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, if it's incorporating Freemasonry, you got there's a shitload of Freemasons in Chicago even to this day.
Does this seem like a response to all of the humanist Christianity that was happening at that same time?
To kind of level it?
Like everybody... just like, well, we're not them. Mm. We're going to be this other thing. We're going to pull in Egyptian stuff and all this other crazy stuff that we're not, you know. But it's most notably not Christian.
Yeah.
And we're not doing what they're doing.
You could be right. I almost want to say that it was a lot of bored rich people. Again, with the rich people hanging out with the artists and it's like a...
Yeah, because there were a ton
and
of...
And occultism was a kind of like a cool thing to do in seances. For sure. I mean, maybe that was a little later where it was really more popular.
What was their focus? Why were they even doing it?
Well, why wouldn't you?
To become like a wizard, you know? It's cool.
The stated purpose of the order was to test... purify and exalt the spiritual nature of the individual, and to further what is called the great work, which was to obtain control of the nature and power of one's being. So it's another thing.
It's another humanist kind of thing.
Yeah, I know.
It's like focusing on on another. It's saying humanism through not God, but through this other.
You control your body.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And become a wizard.
One thing that I noticed was that they called the super secret founders of the
the outer order. Outer order was controlled by the inner order, of which only Westcott, Woodman, and Mathers were members. But they were members of the inner order and the only members of the inner.
That kind of bullshit. But then there were the secret chiefs.
Yeah.
And when I think of the name Secret
Chiefs... Self-appointed.
They no one knew who they were. People were like, oh, they're aliens or they're angels. Or
right.
Superhuman adepts. That's what they
were. Exactly. So they were... Secret nobody Chiefs. Knew who they were. But like, even just the name Secret Chiefs, it's almost like... I mean, Chief does not... It's like... Secret...
Really? You chose the word Chief? Is that what you're saying?
I know, yeah. Like, what? It's almost
you should have
like,
chose Colonel. Come
but
on.
Like, but like, yeah.
Secret Colonel Sanders.
No, I agree. Like, that's what you went with?
Secret bosses.
Right.
No. I think that at the time, the notion of a chief was right. more exotic.
Oh yeah,
right?
They're bringing the exoticism.
You're
in,
talking
sure.
about Africa. You're talking for about sure. Native Americans. You're talking about, and it's like, and chief is somehow to us now that yeah. word does not hold
have
the
same.
The,
yeah, no way.
I mean, it's insane when you look at what they were grabbing. It was kind of like they were just picking and choosing. They were like, oh, that's kind of cool.
That's cool.
Freemason
cool
concept.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what look they at this. All do.
Yeah, but like, exactly so right. they're saying, so the secret chiefs that were thought to be entities of the astral plane. and then there was a hierarchy astral. Based upon the tree of life of the Kabbalah with 10 grades corresponding to the tree of life's 10 sephiroth. I don't know enough about Kabbalah to actually don't know anything about it.
Let's ask Madonna.
Yeah. Call her up. The order taught three magical
she's not
systems.
Aging. That's mostly the robot.
Robot Donna. So they had three magical systems: the Key of Solomon, a Bramelin, and a Nokian. And it also gave instruction in astral travel, scrying. Do you know what scrying is?
Scrying is scrying is any kind of.
Is it crying really hard?
It's scribble crying.
Looking through a crystal ball.
Oh, okay.
Or any
this,
other.
What's that one? It's like automatic writing. That's what that one's called.
Yeah, it's basically scrying is watching someone from afar.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool word.
Alchemy, tarot,
they were flipping
astrology.
Through the.
Yes, they're like,
oh, they're
that
like
one.
Scrying. That's cool.
Alchemy's awesome. Let's do alchemy.
No, when you read it, it sounds like Harry Potter or something. Like
shit,
they're just
I
like,
know, right? It's
let's put some stuff together.
And they were totally neat. Like, and the thing is,
well, they were selling it.
Well, that's the other question. It's like, okay, you guys just made this up. So, somebody here knows that it's all bullshit. Somebody here knows.
Yeah.
But the question is, do people then start actually thinking it or believing it? Even the people who know it's bullshit, after a while, they're like, they start buying it because they have all this power and it pays for them to buy it.
Isn't that every religion?
They were able to get followers and some big names. I mean,
they published a shit ton of books. I know that one guy was like, he had like no less than 5 to 7 names that he published under. The Wynne Westcott guy.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a couple of like
oh, really?
His book. Oh yeah, like wow. Mental Magic. Like it's very much close to the, remember the Rhonda Byrne Law, The Secret book?
Huh.
That came out, that the whole DVD set. Do you guys remember this a couple years back? Where,
no.
like, you can just listen to tapes and things will come to you. You'll win a lottery because you just feel like you'll win the lottery, you know? That
awesome.
Kind of shit. Yeah. I've tried nothing and I'm all out of ideas. I'm just going to sit around and fucking get stuff because I thought about it. But she basically ripped off all that stuff. She went back because the reason why, this is the reason, it was public domain at that point. So she could.
Oh.
Yeah, she knew exactly what she was doing. So it's all snake oil.
Yeah. And I mean, like, some of the names they had.
It's thought law is what they call it.
Thought law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thoughts are things. They're not just thoughts. Like, vibrational shit, you know, all that weirdness.
Well, they're trying to purify and exalt the spiritual nature of the individual, so.
Become a wizard. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's basically what it was, but you know, when I was reading these names, I started thinking about the Algonquin. And the round table.
Totally.
It seemed like people were like, oh yeah, totally. So you have like, so they say, the distinguished membership, including such figures as distinguished homeopath Dr. Edward Barrage, Scottish astronomer Royal William Peck, Arthur Edward Waite, who's an authority in Kabbalah, W.B. Yeats is like the big, real big name in there.
I saw Bram Stoker on there too.
Yeah, they had a
Sir
guy
Arthur
who was in
Conan Doyle.
Yeah,
who was his name?
People dug it, man.
Dr. R.W. Falcon, who was a Nobel Prize winning physician.
That's like a Death Eater name,
right?
It's like
right,
you know, fantasy novelist Arthur. I'm gonna butcher that. Arthur Machen and Algernon Blackwood. And then
Algernon Blackwood.
Couldn't make that if I wanted to. That's brilliant.
And then some others like
nom de plume right there. Take that.
There was a an Irish a theater actress, Moina Bergson, who was the sister of Henri Bergson. You're a philosopher, so.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And then Maud Gonne, who was big in the Irish Revolution. And then, like, a bunch of other people. But one of the most famous names that popped out is Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, he's
the guy.
He's the dude. So, he's
the rock star of the whole thing.
You were talking about how, like, it just sort of, like, splintered at a point. It didn't last that long because it started going in different directions. And they said that once the Crowley joined, he kind of rose through the ranks really, really fast. It's just, like, you take oaths, and it you can see, like, all these people are like, yeah, this is great. This is awesome. Yeah. You know, like,
it's like a pyramid, thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes you feel like you want to wash afterwards.
So Woodman died in 1891, and he wasn't replaced. And then Aleister Crowley joined in 1898. And then he and Mathers fell out, and then that's when it says the antagonism between them is said to have led to they're engaging in a psychic war that went on for years. I was like, obviously. And so they were both expelled from the order because of this.
This is our movies, though, yeah, right? Yeah. Right? Like, you know, Magneto and Dr. X or whatever, yeah. You know? Yeah. It's like...
And this is over 100 years ago, so it's, I mean, what were these guys
So it's smoking? Clearly true. Obviously. They were having a psychic
Anything
war.
Past 30 years ago is true.
You know, and they have this... I found this... It was from a book called. Actually, it was from the works of Aleister Crowley, but it was a poem that describes the initiation of the true Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn in its spiritual aspect. And it's long, so I'm not going to read it. But there's some choice phrases in here. It's like, with whirling cries of pride, sought out the tomb where lurking vampires battened, and my steel. Has wrought its splendor through the gates of death. And it's like, as if I choked, some horror creeps between the spirit of my will and its desire. And the whole time I'm reading, I'm like, this sounds like a fucking H.P. Lovecraft book. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, he was into that shit.
You know, like, it's just, you're talking about vampires and... Oh, light, but descend, again, my feet move vaguely on.
But again, it's just, it's what you touched on. It's that pick and choose... Harry yeah. Potter buzzword shit, you know?
Yeah.
It was the vampire love story of the time kind of thing.
I feel the spring, the all-devouring dawn. So, yeah. That are beyond
gods. But he led
gods
to Luciferianism and Satanism, though, I think.
Crowley. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's the
man. He was the guy.
Yeah.
He was on to great things.
Yeah, I think the rest of them, it almost sounds like, you know, the rest of them were kind of like, oh, this is fun.
Yeah.
You know, we chant.
But I mean, ultimately...
Where could this go?
we drink a little blood.
Ultimately, yeah. It went on to all of the occult in America and Britain, France.
Right. Yeah.
Like, it's... This is the foundation for it.
These guys. Yeah.
For sure.
Well, because, yeah, you get a few people who are really, really taking it seriously. I think a lot of these people, they were like, oh, what's this now? Oh, sure, I'll join. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I got nothing going on Thursday night.
Sounds like
fun.
Let's go.
Yeah, it'll be a hoot.
Yeah.
Next thing
can
you know,
I bring a friend?
You're drinking blood.
Do we really have to drink the blood, or can we just drink Golden Dawn cocktails?
A lot of their stuff was Egyptian type.
It was mystery.
And Egyptology was huge back then, too. I mean, people
was in vogue.
It was all a... It was all a fun little distraction.
Yeah, for sure.
So Golden Dawn. It looks like a beautiful...
It looks really lovely. It does look like a beautiful drink.
What was the blue one that we did that was like this? It was blue.
Violet
or something?
Oh, the Blue Moon? Or
something where we came to a similar conclusion where it was like, we were like, it's blue.
Yeah.
Done. Right, it looks like the sunrise.
Yes. Yeah. Stop trying to analyze it. It's there's it's sometimes there is to... not an explanation other than how it looks, which is pretty atypical, I would say. I mean, in most cases, I don't think we come across drinks where it's like, well, it just looks like
or you actually have like the communist where it's like it's red, but now you have to go into why communism.
Yeah, why
is affiliated with
chose
red?
Red, yeah,
it's
right.
Like, so.
But at the time, though, when it's created, it's just a thing.
Yeah.
Isn't it a hoot? That, you know, look, communists are funny. and they like red. They wear red, right? So yeah. Let's just, there we go. The drinks, the, but this does look like a sunrise.
Yeah, it's just, it's a direct, it's a straight line.
It doesn't look like racism, so I'm pretty sure it's not the movie
doesn't look or, like, or if that's what you saw, like you've got some problems.
I know, right? It's like, you know what?
What a Rorschach that is.
That musical by Rodgers and Hammerstein.
I see horrible racist blackface. I don't know what you see. I see a sunrise.
Okay, well, that was fun.
Yeah.
I kind of want to see it in action, and I want to drink it in action.
Yeah, I got to imagine the grenadine part is, because it must, whatever the ingredients are, it must be thick enough for the grenadine to just kind of gather rather than mix in.
Mm. Yeah.
It looks nice. It's probably fucking strong. I mean, that is a lot of booze. And the gin is throwing me off, because Calvados and brandy, I mean, it's just, I feel brandy
like
and brandy.
Gin back then was a filler, kind of like vodka. They didn't have vodka then, so it's like, well, we need to add something that doesn't add a lot of flavor.
This is to make it a little lighter.
Yeah. And they're like used to gin or something, they must have been.
Well, that they literally did not have the vodka.
So
if you wanted a clear alcohol so that you could do stuff with color, and you could have something that didn't have a lot of flavor of its own.
Oh.
The Golden Dawn, 3/4 ounce, Domaine DuPont Calvados, 3/4 ounce, Ford's Gin, 3/4 ounce, Marie Brizard, apricot flavored brandy, 3/4 ounce, orange juice, grenadine.
Okay, so we are here at the Brixton in Andersonville in Chicago. And just as a side note, I haven't said this in a while, but if you're ever in Andersonville in Chicago, come to the Brixton, get good cocktails, eat really good food. They have a great menu. So just a little plug for them because they are really cool and we get to play in their liquid playground here. So that's pretty awesome. We are going to drink a Golden Dawn. We already discussed the history, what of it there was, and now we're going to try one. And it looks delicious, and the ingredients look awesome. I'm here with Kevin Ratajczak.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Kevin, do you care how your cocktail looks?
Yeah, I guess I kind of do. I mean, I like just a booze delivery system, but when I get one that looks cool, it adds something to it.
Is there anything about a cocktail that scares you? Like, if it's, like, neon blue or something, does that make you go, eek, or does that make you go, huh?
No, not really. Though, I have to admit, the first thing that came to mind were the crazy Bloody Marys that we see with, like, cheeseburgers on a stick on the side. But I'm not daunted. I would attack that cheeseburger.
Yeah, see, that's the only part I go for, is the hanging cheeseburger. We're also here with Rachel Rubin.
Hello.
Rachel, do you care how your cocktails look?
Much that I care, but I think I form a certain judgment about them depending on how they look. But I mean, that's also kind of unfair considering how many cocktails we've had that are kind of like vaguely white person flesh colored that we've had on the show. Like, you know, I mean, you could pull up, I mean, I pull up pictures on my phone of the cocktails that we've had, and they're all like sort of peach colored, sort of transparent.
I feel almost that like there were more of those that were successes. That like the ones that we went, ooh, that's so pretty, were just not as good.
But I mean, like, I also think, like, I mean, there's sort of a judgment attached to it. I mean, like, if you get something that's like unnaturally blue colored from like blue Curacao or something, my mind goes to like, oh, this drink is like something I could get at Chi Chi's.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, there's kind of a judgment in that.
And there's also the whole unnatural coloring of foods. This has red dye number cancer.
I say that there's a judgment in there. I don't necessarily mean it's a positive or negative judgment, because I mean, I would drink the hell out of like a blue Chi Chi's margarita, but I mean, still, like, you have a certain connotation depending on how what your drink looks like.
Even novelty, like, just like, hey, I've got a crazy blue drink.
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's a certain feeling associated with it.
I'm starting to feel like how people who were 40 when Nirvana became popular felt. You know, with all of the flannel and the dirty hair and everything, and it's just like, and the grunge scene, it was just...
You're going to grow a beard now, right?
Me? You know what? All of these fancy brewer's beards that are out, I can't do it.
Father who has, like I didn't know it was capable for him.
Is your father a hipster now?
No.
No, but he's got
like,
a beard.
My father, like... Just as a rule, like, does not have...
He has no arm hair.
He has no arm hair. He has no chest hair. He has no hair on his legs. He would tell me, like, you know, he doesn't shave that often because he doesn't grow a lot of facial hair. He managed to grow a goatee. I was blown away. I was like, holy...
Oh, it suits him, too.
Oh, it's good? Okay.
I just didn't know it was possible. Because he's, like, hairless. I mean, he has hair on his head, which is fine. But anyway, that's not...
I look kind of like a catfish. Yeah, tufts, and it's like, yeah, this is not worth it.
Yeah, but if you keep growing it, you'll be surprised what happens.
I have done it, and even when it's like full, it's still kind of erratic. What?
Were you over 40 when you grew it?
No. No, my wife won't love me if I grow a beard. Yeah, it's the abrasion with the face and other things.
It will itch for about another 3-4 days. There's nothing I can do about it.
If you grow a beard, they'll cancel each other out.
That's true.
It'll be like Velcro, maybe. That'd be nice. I still have not introduced Mr. Eric Martin.
Hi, Cam. Thank you for being a friend.
Shouldn't that be sung?
Yeah, from a music guy. I mean, geez. Okay, and you, do you care how your cocktail looks?
I'm always a bit wary of cream-based drinks that have lime garnishes.
It was like a lemon bar martini, and it had cream and lemon in it, and it worked okay.
That's very scary. Mixer. That is the recipe for cottage cheese.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking, that it was going to curdle.
It's vile. Really, that's the only thing that would bother me. I would try pretty much anything else, I think.
You're, like, totally into aesthetics and everything. If it's too garish, it doesn't then go to kitsch.
I appreciate execution of anything. So if you are going for kitsch and you get really great looking kitsch, then you've succeeded, in my opinion.
Okay. That's very Greek. The idea that, you know, if you're gonna be an asshole, be the best damn asshole you can be, and then it's okay. It's all about the execution. You have to, like, make sure that you do it right.
That you descend as far as possible.
So, yeah, like a tequila sunrise or, like, this kind of drink that we're going to have now, I think that's a cool look with, the, like, the red and the tulle layer. And, like, a black and tan. That's not a cocktail. But, I mean, that's a cool drink. You know, it looks, adds a little something to the experience.
What if it doesn't taste good? Is it still valuable?
Ooh, well, no. The black and tan works. It's really good.
See here, okay, so we have it has arrived.
Uh-huh. All right.
Oh, but it comes undressed.
Well, I'm plating it here. All right, so it's equal parts four ingredients. Orange juice, which of course you know what that is. The Marie Blizzard, the apricot liqueur. As well as another 3/4 ounces of gin, and then another 3/4 ounces of the Calvados. You shake that, you strain it into a cocktail glass, which I've done, and they say put a maraschino cherry in there, so I dropped a cherry in there. Now, we don't float things to the bottom, we put a stem in it. And then, last but not least, it says dribble a little bit of grenadine and let it float to the bottom. Yeah. And it should create a little bit of a nipple, for lack of a better word.
That brings a whole new meaning to Golden Dawn.
It's not that strong of a drink, but it certainly is flavorful. It's, you know, it's like any time you put orange juice in something, you know, you're adding a lot of sweetness and a lot of volume to it. It doesn't make sense. I'll be honest with you. It doesn't make sense to drizzle the grenadine in. You don't get any flavor. It hits the bottom. So I'd imagine that's all for aesthetics.
Yeah.
And it's probably what they had.
It's,
you know.
It's to make the golden dawn.
Yeah. Yes. I was just gonna say, if you want it in the drink, you shake it in there.
So it should drink all right. I imagine you could have a few of them. The ingredients aren't that strong. But again, you're still talking about, well, let's see, 1.5. You're still talking over 2 ounces of liquor. So no matter what, yeah, you don't break till you hit the lake.
It looks effervescent. What do we have in there that's strong?
There's no soda in there.
So maybe it's just like from being shaken, or maybe it's like from the orange juice, like some pulp or something. It's delicious.
It's one of those tan drinks, though.
It is.
It is a tan drink. I think if you want it to be less tan, you got to put more grenadine in it, which I don't know if that would necessarily contribute.
I don't know if
it
would make it better. It would make it look prettier. Yeah.
I don't know if that would necessarily make it taste any better, but it would make it more striking.
More striking.
You could just add red food coloring.
Gummy candy.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
That is the strangest flavor. I did not expect that at all. It's almost like, would you say vanilla?
More almond.
Okay, yeah, I
could see the almond.
Probably the apricot. Is apricot brandy made with the kernels or with the flesh of the fruit?
See, this is the thing about this is that this is apricot flavored brandy.
Is that different than apricot brandy?
Interesting.
So it's not, I would assume that it's not actually made with apricots. It's like brandy that is then infused with the flavor of apricots.
Isn't all brandy made from grapes?
Calvados is made from apples.
I think we really need to cast it in a revival of Cinderella to find out whether it's brandy or not.
I agree with that.
I keep making musical jokes and no
one's... In my own little chair, I can eat whoever I want to eat. Yeah.
What was that? What? Wait, what?
Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you? At least some.
It's my Cinderella version, where Cinderella eats everyone.
Except for Whoopi Goldberg, because Whoopi Goldberg is awesome. Up and they eat the world together.
Yes. Devouring everyone.
They eat everyone except for a class of high school students whom they train to sing and then go on a tour of the empty
He's
eaten
never
world.
Seen Sister Act 2. I was like, I think we need to break up because you haven't seen Sister Act 2.
Well, I liked her in Star Trek.
Do you like uplifting movies? Uplifting films. Are you a fan of uplifting
yes,
films?
Like
Cool Runnings?
Yes, like Cool Runnings. Or are you a fan of strong women leading films?
Absolutely.
Are you a fan of 90s music?
Not really.
Well, then you'll half like this film and half loathe it.
Yeah.
But I recommend it
especially
anyway.
Especially if it's popular 90s music.
It's not.
Okay.
It's not.
Then there's a chance.
Sister Act 2 is arguably better than Sister Act 1.
I would agree. That's an argument among Sister Act fans, which one is better. I like 2.
Yeah.
Because I love sassy black women, and there are more of them in Sister Act 2.
And they go to, like, musical singing competitions.
Ooh, and you get to see all the stuck-up white kids.
Yeah.
They're all nuns in the first one.
Yeah.
You're rooting for them, but you're not as
Wait
invested.
A minute. It's called Sister Act. Aren't there any sisters in the second?
Yeah, the sisters...
But
the
they're
sisters
more supporting, like... They're not. They don't play as big a role.
Oh.
They're not the choir itself.
The sisters from the first movie take over a Catholic school in the second movie.
And they literally fight and beat the man. It's amazing.
Well, I did watch one movie that Rachel suggested I check out, Snowpiercer.
Oh, I tried watching that one, but I got sad and I stopped.
Did you see it?
Nope.
I can't watch sad movies anymore.
I like this cocktail, but I'm not blown away by it.
If they soaked a lot of fruit in this cocktail mix, I would prefer to eat the fruit soaked in it than I would drink the actual cocktail, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a cocktail winner.
It won over many other applicants.
Well, yeah. Frankly, 1,500 seems a little bit too much. The contest was sponsored by the UK Bartenders Guild. And they're actually still an organization that exists now. They're still active. And they started in the 30s, and they made their own cocktail book. And it's one of the books that has a lot of the cocktails that we've done. they were on a special mission to catalog every cocktail out there to determine what the ingredients are and by what portions and list them by name. They were on that mission to define every drink. It seemed like they were doing these contests. They were hiring people to make drinks. They were just making tons of drinks to put it, to cram in their book. But in addition, like, you can find the sidecar and you can find the martini and everything. But that whole sense of making the definition of, like, nailing down the drinks was something that is so very true after Prohibition. Prior to Prohibition, a lot of the really popular classic cocktails are all over the fucking place. If you ask for an Aviation, you don't know what you're going to get. Everybody's got a different version. If you ask for a Corpse Reviver, there's all of these different versions out there, and every bartender has their own one. Prohibition was this dead zone where nobody was really making good drinks anymore, and the craft of bartending kind of stopped. On the other side of Prohibition, there were a few bartenders who saw the writing on the wall, wrote their books, and published them immediately. So not only did you have people across the pond in England and France who were maintaining the cocktail tradition, but then in America, after Prohibition, it spiked, and there was an interest in it, and there were people who were at the forefront saying, oh, remember martinis? This is what it is. And once they did that, from that point on, a lot of the drinks held. The variations did not happen as much. So it was kind of a wiping of the slate clean, coming to definitive terms with all of the drinks that came before. And we've seen that in a lot of different cocktails. Prior to Prohibition, it's a shit show. After Prohibition, there were so few people who were on top of it, and because they wrote essentially the dictionary of cocktails that came out, everybody was like, I have that book, and now I know what an Aviation is.
That's an effect you see in more than just cocktails. Like, the Grimm's brothers went around and basically set different folktales in stone until the present day when Disney is redoing all of them. Just, like, setting a version of it forever. And there may be some riffs on it eventually, but you always have that that original, quote-unquote, to go back to.
In their case, it's almost like, because they were the first to write them down, right?
Yeah, it's they were saying, these are the tales of the people we've been with for the past few weeks, and this is the story they're telling. And
so all the other variations were just excluded because they weren't bound.
Exactly. It goes back even to the Bible, when there were a ton of different Gospels, and a group of people sat down and said, this is what we're going to decide to believe. And everything else was either destroyed or hidden away in the sand and found 2,000 years later. So it's not just cocktails. It happens in every field you can think of. In musicology, all these folk songs were collected by various people around the turn of the 20th century. And now the songs that we know as folk songs were set down on paper by these people.
But it seems to me that music has a little bit more variation because everybody's... Like, everybody can have a take on it.
I mean, anyone can have a take on a cocktail, too, but you can always go back to that first record and see what they said was the original.
Was there a period of time where it was unacceptable to make music other than the original?
Probably church music.
Because that's kind of what I feel like is happening right after Prohibition.
All churches.
No, dude, churches, they improvise. Are you kidding me? I've listened to church music.
For a very long time, it was very frowned upon to improvise on church music. I'm talking about the Middle Ages, especially Gregorian chants.
So that ritual.
There was a definitive way to do it. There was no other way. If you did it differently, it was unacceptable.
Exactly. And things only changed when people broke the rules and the... Basically, boredom took over for all these monks and composers who were singing this stuff every day, and they started becoming more and more complex. And back when people didn't have a lot of entertainment other than music, going to church and hearing something new was a good way to keep people interested in church, and so it generally became acceptable. So I mean, a lot of the variations we see in bars today may have a similar thing. Like, you can go to a bar and get an apple tini, and it's a variation of something that came before.
And this is really interesting, because if you carry the metaphor through, the Middle Ages, in terms of music, like, there's a dead period of knowledge and transfer of ideas, and it seems like, in terms of cocktailing, there's this dead period. And on the other side of it, you come up with these rules that define what the proper way things are to be. And it stays that way for quite some time. I think now, yeah, we are seeing, you know, every bar, every craft cocktail place has their own Manhattan. They have their own French 75. They have 10 French 75s. And, you know, they have no problem changing it around. But I feel like at that time, right after Prohibition, and maybe this is true of music as well, they felt like, you know, we lost this. A way to hold on to it is to define it, is to give it a name and to give it structure so that it can't go away ever again.
Once you define something, in my opinion, you start to lose it, because there will instantly be a rebellion against it.
But people don't think that way. They think when you define it, when you have, then you own it. It's like knowing the devil's name in entirety. You know, once you know the demon's name, you can control it.
Is Rumpelstiltskin a demon?
I think that it's playing into the same mythology, and I think that that's kind of true psychologically. You know, that like it, when you can identify, define, name, when you know all of the parts, then you're its master, and in that way, then it can't leave, or it can't go away, or whatever. But, like Eric was saying, that's kind of false, because at that point, then it can start to shift and change.
Well, there are never any clean lines. You can never fully name something. I mean, when they started to break down the atom and figure out what was in it, they started finding things that didn't make sense. So, the same thing applies to cocktail making, or music, or art, or literature. There are no clean lines, so you can't really name something and control it.
You're absolutely right. I totally agree. But I think that the attempt was made for those reasons. Not overtly. It's not like they were thinking, well, if I name it, then I can control it. It's one of those, like, effects of the way people think based on understanding the world. And even though we're drawn to do that, but at the same time, I agree with you that it is a fruitless endeavor, that, like, actually doing it causes more problems in many cases.
Well, I wouldn't say it causes more problems. I think label making is very useful, in that people who make labels may expect one thing, but they inadvertently cause progress, because when you try to do something, there will always be someone to oppose you, and I think that's very good. Labels are great. They don't work, but they're great.
I would say it's interesting, and it's on the side of good. I enjoy it. I like it.
It's a lot more sophisticated than a screwdriver.
That's not saying much, though.
Well, that's true. That's just two straight-up ingredients. Yeah. A way to get, you know,
yeah, it's a way to
vodka in your system. Yeah.
And get vitamin C.
Does anybody drink screwdrivers after the age of, like, 19?
I think I would if I had brunch 3 weekends in a row. And I was really, really sick of other brunch drinks.
It is better. It's better when you get to the grenadine at the bottom.
So they should have just made a pink drink and called that something else.
Did you get the grenadine?
I made a point to stir it up after the comments about the grenadine improving things.
It's probably very good.
There may have been too much cocktail left when I stirred it up. I did not get much of an improvement. I don't hate it. I don't think I would make it myself.
No.
Personally, I enjoy a cocktail that I can just, like, 2 or 3 ingredients that I dump together and get very drunk.
That's why we're here. Because we can make Michael do it.
I'm with you on that, though. We're constantly making Manhattans at home, or we're always making, like, sidecars at home. Because they're tasty. It's a very distinct, like, you're drinking Manhattan, you know you're drinking Manhattan. There's a distinct flavor profile, and it's like all the ingredients are wonderful. In Manhattan, it's, you know, bourbon forward. It's like, you know, it's kind of strong, sweet bourbon drink. That's what you get.
And it's very, it's pretty easy.
Yeah, it's very easy.
You're not making the Crimean cup at home.
Yeah. The hardest part is shaking it.
Same thing with a sidecar. The hardest part of a sidecar is juicing a lemon.
Yeah, yeah, with the brandy.
But yeah, a sidecar is lemon juice, Cointreau, and brandy. Which, I mean, like, how can you go wrong?
See, I think this drink, I kind of wonder about its role in this book as a forgotten cocktail, because I would feel like it was forgotten fairly quickly. There have been cases where some cocktails that had more ingredients actually were fairly popular for a time period. I mean, they're not home friendly at all. But I feel like some of these are just interesting ones that he picked out of a lineup, you know, that really didn't gain any traction.
I feel that any cocktail should be more than the sum of its parts. And if it is not, it might not be worth making. This had a lot of really interesting ingredients and things that I wouldn't normally put into a beverage, but I wasn't really getting the quality of those ingredients or their distinctiveness or feeling like it would have been any worse without them.
So that's Calvados right there.
The apple brandy. It's interesting.
Isn't it potent?
Yeah. Very potent.
Oh, yeah. That's not a ball of being...
Not as good as the Kirschwasser, though.
Oh, well, it's 80 proof, though.
But it's potent, and it has a flavor besides just the alcohol.
Yeah, yeah.
Something this potent, I probably wouldn't pair with a lot of other liqueurs or liquors.
Calvados is very popular in these forgotten cocktails.
That's interesting to me.
It seems kind of like a popular old world drink. You know, like, it was probably more available and there were more people who liked it. Its country cousin is Applejack.
Right.
That's the American version, so.
This on its own, I like more than the cocktail.
I like that more than the cocktail.
Me too.
The apple or the apricot flavored stuff.
This just tastes like boozy candy, though.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just like, it doesn't necessarily taste like apricots. It's just, it's sweet and it's boozy.
Pretty good.
I mean, like, really, how can you go wrong?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a bottle of booze candy. That's what that is.
Awesome.
It's wonderful. I mean...
But it's not improved by being added to the cocktail.
No, no. I would love to taste a liqueur that's like actually apricot flavored. Like I think of like I really love to eat those like dried apricots.
That's actually made with apricots.
Or like really super steeped with it. Like I think like I love to eat those dried apricots.
A bottle of nice vodka and some dried apricots and make
or
it
like
yourself.
I have a giant bottle of Christian Brothers brandy at home. I could just kind of
use it.
Yeah.
Totally.
I got a project now. I'll go over to Aldi and get some of those dried apricots there.
The problem you may have is that dried apricots can get a musty, aged flavor that would come across pretty strongly.
Maybe you should use something like nectarines instead. When do cherries come into season? When do Michigan cherries come into season?
They should be.
Soon.
Yeah, soon. I am on a mission to make my own really good maraschino cherries because I still have like half a bottle of Luxardo. So I'm on a mission. I'm going to do it this year.
You could call it Red Light District.
Oh, nice.
I think that would be, well, a very good marketing ploy.
It is.
And just put a very fancy lady and her bloomers on the label.
But is it as good as yeast confection?
God, yeast confection, my dream business.
Your dream cottage cheese production business?
No, yeast confection is the...
I thought it was yeast confection.
Yes, yeast confection.
Okay.
Yes. The beer bar / donut shop that I'm going to open.
I mean, that sounds like a place I would frequent. And
how about muffins?
Jars of your Red Light District maraschino cherries.
Okay. There, it would be a bonus.
Okay.
I think this is a good idea.
Oh my god.
We could have like specialty, we could like, you know, it'd be it'd specialize in beers, but then you could have like, you know, you have like a rotating cocktail list where like all the cocktails are named after some form of BD.
You could have a very strong cocktail called Syphilis.
So we tried the Golden Dawn, Was it worth the hype?
It wasn't worth the hype.
No.
It would not be stored in Fort Knox.
I liked it. I thought it was okay. It wasn't amazing. I think that we've encountered amazing cocktails. I thought it was good. It was fine. I feel like I would pick it over others. And I appreciated the story. I thought that was fun, too. And we didn't even talk about cultists at the bar. So check us out on Facebook and on Twitter. I do history blasts on Twitter. Twitter blasts. That's fun to say. We have our own site, blackliverproject.com, of course. So go there, and you can listen to the shows. You can download it on iTunes. And you should do so, as well as subscribe and then say how awesome we are, because it's just the way it is. So until next time, keep on thinking and drinking, and we'll blacken your liver. Bye now.
I made it the whole time without making a golden shower joke. I'm so proud of myself.
Good job.
And actually, did Mickey, we didn't hear all of it, did Mickey finally go there? Because I know he
never
to.
Went there.
He didn't go there?
No.
I've expected him to.
No, he was distracted. He was really excited by the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
It's the low-hanging fruit of this episode.
Oh, no, but Mickey goes for the low-hanging fruit sometimes.
Mickey likes his low fruit.
As the clouds turn, a mind rewinds. A thought I had of you in the sunrise. My dreams in a trance trace us back to the dance floor we met in the moonlight.
Thanks for listening to the Monster in a Glass podcast. I'd like to thank Jason Cruz for researching our content, our regular tasting team, Rachel Rubin, Kevin Ratajczyk, Bethany Lang, and Nicole Pizzini, for joining me in the grueling task of tasting the cocktails we discuss, the Brixton and their bartender, Michael Donnelly, for letting us cavort in their liquid playground, Dan Cruz for art direction and editing, and Mark Piani for the music at the head of the show. Go to blackliverproject.com to see the show archive, become a member, contribute to the project, and get in touch with us. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest news and as-it-happens updates during live events. And as always, if you're into thinking and drinking, let us blacken your liver.
Baby, dancing till dawn and on and on.